Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast where founders talk about building drinks brands in a changing world. I'm Felicity Carter, and today I'm with Alison Luvera, co-founder of Juliet. It's a premium boxed wine brand she launched with longtime friend Lauren De Niro Pfeiffer. It's a sleek, beautifully designed cylindrical package that has sustainability claims, a DTC engine, and national retail traction. They've landed Whole Foods, Costco, and even the Bellagio. Juliet is raising eyebrows and raising capital. But look closer and you'll see the risks. Reinventing the format, educating the trade, and convincing skeptical investors that boxed wine can go premium. For more insights like these, subscribe to the Drinks Insider newsletter at drinksinsider.com. Now, here's my conversation with Alison Luvera. Alison, it's great to meet you.
So great to see you. Thanks for having me on today.
All right, let's get into this. You have one of the most beautiful boxed wine products I've ever seen, but your background is not in wine. So what was the moment that convinced you that what the world needed was a premium boxed wine?
Yeah, I remember the moment distinctly. So I was, you know, it was back in the pandemic days, the early days of the pandemic, and I was at my parents' house in upstate New York, and they had a box of wine in the fridge. I think it was Blue Nun Riesling. I remember thinking, this is such a great experience. You know, I can have one glass at a time, one glass per night, which for me is how I like to drink, right? It's like wine on tap in the fridge. I just thought it was a fantastic experience, but it was, you know, not exactly the quality or style or design standards that I was personally looking for in the wines that I typically buy.
No, we will call it a classic. It is a classic wine, probably probably not.
Respect for that.
Yes, that's right. Let's be respectful of history. Okay, so it was the pandemic. What made you decide that you were going to launch it?
I went back home to LA where I lived at the time. I went to the local Whole Foods. I was sort of looking like, oh, is there a box wine that is sort of the style of wine that I'm looking for? Couldn't really find anything. Like I kind of came up empty, started researching box wine as a whole. Like again, pandemic, I went down a rabbit hole. What else do you have to do, right? And one thing that really struck me was that, you know, box wine is the most eco-friendly wine packaging. Mm. You know, glass bottles and their transport are actually the number one contributor to wine's carbon footprint as a whole. And box wine offers a really sustainable alternative to that. And so that got me really excited. There is this sort of negative stigma against box wine in the US, and there's no logical reason for that. You know, there's no functional reason high-end wine can't go in a box and that consumers can't enjoy it in that way. And I thought with, you know, with my fashion background and some of my luxury wine and spirits marketing background, and then combined with the background of my business partner, you know, we thought if anybody's going to do this, if anybody's going to really transcend box wine and create a product and a brand that is, you know, resonating with sort of the modern aspirational consumer, we thought it could be us.
So I should ask you about your business partner. How did that come about? I think you've been friends for a long time. Is that right?
We have. I've known Lauren for 20 years now, which really ages me. We met in college through mutual friends. And then, you know, in our early days of our career, we were both working in fashion in New York. And so we, you know, we were at a lot of the same events. We were, you know, we had a lot of the same friends. And so we became very, very close. We both moved on from fashion and pursued careers in different spaces. Myself in wine and spirits. I worked at Pernod Ricard for many years. And Lauren went on to have some really interesting roles with Virgin Galactic, selling tickets to space. She worked at Uber for some time.
Okay. So I was going to say, what makes you decide to do something as risky as launching a wine company? But I think if you're selling tickets to space, you probably think very big. So whose idea was it? Did you go and say, let's launch a wine company? Or did Lauren suggest it?
You know what? We've always tossed around the idea for many years of doing something together. We're both wine lovers. I had just gone down this path of researching box wine. And so I think we were just on the phone catching up during the pandemic and talking about maybe launching something, as we had many times before. And I was like, oh, well, I had this interesting idea recently because, you know, of this experience I had at my parents' house, and I've been looking into it, and she loved the idea. She's, you know, her and I, we're both wine lovers. We're both everyday wine drinkers, right? We both really enjoy a great glass of wine at the end of a long day. And so for us, it felt like something that was not only a unique, incredible business opportunity, but something that we both would love doing. So that got us both very excited.
Yeah, I take it if you worked for a major company like Pernod Ricard that you already had some understanding of the wine industry. Did you already understand about supply and where to get it from and how to do it? Or did you have to do all of that from scratch?
So we did have to do it all from scratch. I will say that working in and around the industry gave me a little bit of a leg up. I wasn't going in blind. I had contacts. So it was definitely not something I had direct experience doing. My background is marketing. I don't have any direct experience in operations and supply chain, but I certainly had a foundation of knowledge, and a you know, a network of people that I could reach out to for help. I remember in the early days, I reached out to a friend of mine who had launched a rosé brand called La Fête du Rosé and, you know, asked him for tips. So I had a lot of, you know, connections like that where I could, you know, reach out to someone, share what I was doing, ask for advice, and maybe ask for connections. And that's actually how we ended up finding our first winemaking partner. I actually reached out to someone I knew because I was a part of their wine club. It was a Central Coast winery that my partner and I would visit a lot, and we were part of their wine club. And I reached out to them and said, we're looking for a custom crush partner for this exciting new project. Do you know anybody? And he connected me to one of his friends that had a winery in the area, and the stars really aligned. It was a really great connect for us. So I think just having that foundation of knowledge and that foundational network helped us put the pieces together a little bit faster than if we had no experience or no network.
All right. So explain what Eco Magnum is and how you came to develop it. And why did you develop it rather than just using something that already exists?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the truth is, and we've shared this before, we actually didn't initially set out to create our own form factor. We were initially intending to take an off-the-shelf traditional box, put a beautiful design on it, put great wine in it, and then call it a day. And as we were in the early days of developing our brand world and our design aesthetic, and we were working with a partner on, you know, designing the box, it just wasn't landing. I don't know what other way to describe it, but we were seeing these beautiful designs on the box, and it wasn't evoking the type of luxury that we wanted it to evoke. It wasn't, again, like we were trying to really transcend the category visually, and we didn't feel it was getting that accomplished. And so we started to think about, well, what else can we do to visually set ourselves apart on shelf? And so we thought a lot about what's going to make us jump off shelf, knowing that people shop by labels, that they, you know, are more inclined to choose something that really, you know, pops. And so I had this great experience at Pernod Ricard working with high-end whiskeys, tequilas and such. And, you know, it was very common to put together these gorgeous, you know, gift packs for travel and retail or special editions or whatever it might be. And I had recently, you know, not too long ago, I had worked on one that was a cylindrical shape. And so I kind of had that in my head. Like, what if we made this a cylinder? You know, to us, that also was bridging the gap between boxes and bottles really nicely. You know, bringing that classic shape to a new format. And so, you know, from there, we started ideating, reaching out to different, you know, manufacturers and product engineers to try to see what was actually possible. And it started an iterative process where we landed on the Eco Magnum.
That's really interesting. I was going to actually ask you what logistical difficulties there are, because sometimes when you change the packaging, you know, the lines don't work and whatever. But of course, if it's a bag and box, you've got a a liner and something in it. Did you have to reinvent that, or did that already exist?
I think that our proprietary packaging is our greatest asset. It's become our signature, but it also is at times our greatest challenge, because when you create a new packaging format, there's all of these different unforeseen obstacles that pop up along the way. And so we've definitely had our fair share of challenges. We've been able to move through all of them. But, you know, everything from the perforated opening wasn't strong enough at first. As you mentioned, the interior pouch is industry standard. So we can really work with any standard equipment out there for bib. But, you know, there are modifications that need to be made to accommodate our packaging format. And so
Did you have any disasters along the way?
We haven't had any big disasters. It's more just a steady stream of little optimizations that we have to work around. Fortunately, knock on wood, because you know it's still early days, but we haven't had any big disasters yet.
All right, let's go back a step. Am I right that you went back to do an MBA before you launched Juliet?
I did, yes.
Okay, so that is very responsible of you, because as you probably know, there's a lot of business skills lacking in wine. Why did you choose to do that, and what did you learn that you hadn't learned from, you know, the previous work you'd done?
Yeah, for me, I had a long career in marketing, first in fashion media, then in wine and spirits. Marketing was my bread and butter. It was all I had ever done. And I've also traditionally worked in large organizations where you're fairly siloed. So you don't get a lot of exposure to other functions. You know, for me, I collaborated a lot with sales. I collaborated a lot with, you know, finance and accounting, but operations, supply chain, you know, management strategy, all of this stuff was totally foreign to me. And I'm someone that I like taking risks, but calculated risks. And I wanted to, you know, really do whatever I could to round out my skills and my knowledge and have a broader, you know, skill set to build this business on. We also knew from the beginning we were going to raise money, which is not a decision we took lightly. But just because we had proprietary packaging, there were certain MOQs and things like that. We just knew we had to raise some funds. And I personally felt uncomfortable, you know, looking people in the eye, asking them to invest in us, asking them to, you know, to provide us with capital, and then not, and then feel like I was going to sort of learn as I went. And I know that's a bit of a polarizing thing to say. There's people that definitely wholeheartedly disagree with me. And there's plenty of examples of people that have figured it out as they went and did so very successfully, but it was just not something I was comfortable doing.
Well, there's a lot of examples of people who've blown up other people's money because they had a good idea and didn't know what they were doing as well. So that's really interesting. Did you find it psychologically hard to go and ask for money?
You know what? I think in the very beginning, it was a little bit more challenging for me because it was never anything I had done before. Mm-hmm. But I'm fortunate in that my business partner is a prolific fundraiser.
Great.
Yeah, her experiences at, you know, Uber, she worked in investor-facing roles, selling tickets to space. I mean, she's asking, you know, high net worth individuals to give, you know, to buy these imaginary tickets to space. So I was able to kind of take a little bit of a backseat in the early days and learn a lot from her. And then over time, I was able to take on more of the fundraising role as well and really like hone that skill as well.
That's like a perfect match of skills, actually, you know, with the marketing and fashion and somebody who can sell tickets to space. That's great. So this is a very difficult environment to raise money in, especially once interest rates went up in 2022. And it's very difficult for women to raise money. So how did you convince your first investors to give you money?
So I think it helped that we had something really innovative and really an idea that could impact change in the industry. You know, I think I see a lot of new brands, new ideas coming to the table that are you know, they're kind of like incremental innovation. Mm-hmm. And what we were doing was just totally new. We had this patent pending form factor. We had a complete white space opportunity as it pertains to the category dynamic. So I think we had something really fresh and interesting that really caught people's attention. And so that definitely helped. We also did have sort of a pretty large network of people to go out to. And I think we told a really good story. You know, we had great founder market fit. We had a great story about why we were doing what we wanted to do. And I think that that resonates with people.
So was the first fundraising family and friends, or did you go straight to fundraising another way?
Yeah, it was primarily family and friends in the very, very beginning. And then it expanded from there. So I always say there's a butterfly effect with fundraising. You know, you meet so many people and then you ask them for intros and then you ask those people for intros and it just sort of snowballs and your network gets really, really big after a certain point in time. And so it started with family and friends and expanded from there. Lots of high net worth individuals and angel investors in the beginning. And then over time, a few family offices and smaller funds got excited about what we were doing.
So I'll go back to the fact that it is difficult for women to raise money, especially on new products. So what were the toughest questions that you had to answer?
The toughest question that we often have to answer and we still have to answer to this day is really around the size of the prize. You know, how large could this opportunity be? I think when you're creating a new category, like we are, because higher end box wine didn't really exist in a big way before Juliet, it's really difficult for people to wrap their heads around what it might grow into starting from zero. And so we really had to, you know, get creative and like craft our pitch as it pertains to the response to that sort of question. We emphasize two things, really. We talk about the data and the trends, right? That always resonates with investors. And there's a really interesting story there. If you really break down the size of boxed wine, the size of alternative packaged wine, the growth trends, which have been, you know, growing single double digits over the past decade. And then the share of super premium that, you know, the box wine category has in contrast to the pretty large share super premium has in the traditional bottled wine. So you can talk about all these data and trends and start to paint a picture of category dynamics and, you know, what this might look like if the alternative packaging categories like boxed wine started mirroring the premiumization trends we've seen in the rest of the category. And then from there, we talk about a lot about our leadership. You know, this isn't a trend that's happening to us or that we're following. This is a trend that we're really at the forefront of, that we're taking a role in creating. And, you know, so it can expand in proportion to our efforts and to the efforts of, you know, the wider community that we can galvanize to get on board.
And where did you get the data from? Was this proprietary data that you bought, or was this simply desk research that you could clearly see the trends?
We've had to beg, borrow, and steal for industry data. You know, as a startup, you're working on lean budgets. You can't really afford your Nielsen and IRI subscriptions. And so we've been able to, over time, pull together category data from, you know, whether it's an investor that has the data they can share, or honestly, like some of our competitors that we're friendly with have shared the data because they have it. So we've have a nice little library of data that we've collected over time. I will say we didn't have it from the start. So it's something that we've
database. Small tip, call yourself a journalist to make a media request and then people send you their reports. okay. So if I could just do the timeline. So it's the pandemic. You see that there's this opportunity. You're very responsible. You go and do the MBA. Which came first, the design or the money, or what was the next thing that happened?
So it was really, I think Lauren and I both put a little bit of our own money into the business. And that sort of got us through the design process. So we had the packaging design. We had laid the groundwork for our supply chain. We had sort of the nuts and bolts of the operational side of the business in place before we went out and pitched out our business plan. So that was kind of the timeline. And I think that all happened in really 2021. And that took about 18 months. So, you know, designing the packaging, getting into our first harvest, that took time. And then from there we raised money, and then we didn't actually launch into market. We did sort of a soft launch, at the end of, you know, fall 2022.
Okay, so you launched DTC first. What was the plan around that? Were you intending to be a DTC brand, or was this going to be proof of concept?
Definitely proof of concept. We knew we wanted to be a retail brand from the start, but there were so many unknowns just related to our product, our pricing strategy, customer feedback. Who was our audience going to be? Like, we had our theories, but we didn't really know. And so we really felt strongly that we wanted to give ourselves a period of time testing out proof of concept, pulling customer data in, testing different pricing strategies, and getting some early revenues, right? That also helped continue to get things off the ground. And I'm really glad we did that, because I have to say our pricing strategy changed quite a bit. We decided to go out at the higher end of what we thought was possible, knowing that we could, you know, lower the price, but we probably couldn't raise it. And so we did have a lot of great learnings coming out of that. And there was a lot of validation around who our customer was and what she wanted as well. So all of that was helpful.
So did running DTC can be really labor intensive. Was this something you did out of your lounge room and you had to package things up and send them? Or did you use a professional service and just automate the whole thing?
We used a professional service.
probably good. Do your backing with lots of boxes.
From a compliance perspective, it was something that we felt was, we take a pretty cautious approach to compliance. I know a lot of, brands can potentially live in the gray area. We wanted to be as compliant as possible from day one. And so that was the way that we thought we could do that. And also, free up our time to work on the more important things in our minds, which were really just figuring out our strategy, figuring out our customer, and all of that good stuff.
Okay. So what was the moment where you said, okay, we've done DTC, we've got proof of concept, and you got into retail? What happened to make that happen?
So it's an interesting question. I think, we knew after like 6 to 8 months, we felt like we had our strategy down. We had validated certain things about our strategy. We had adjusted certain things. But a lot of it was predicated on how long it took to find our distributor partners. I think you're probably aware, I'm sure your audience is aware, there's been a lot of consolidation.
There has indeed. Yeah. This is the number one question that people write in and ask me: how do I get into distribution? How did you get into distribution?
Yeah, I'll be honest, at first we couldn't. We talked to a lot of distributors, and a lot of them were really excited about what we were doing, but they wanted to see more proof of concept at retail. And so we spent a period of time working with, our clearance house, Park Street, and hand selling into independent accounts in New York and LA to try to, get that proof of concept in retail in a small way, just in terms of velocity, sales, how many doors can we get into? So that was sort of our interim.
That's interesting. Did you have resistance, or it is beautiful packaging. When people said it, did they say it's beautiful, but, or did they say I'll try it, but I'm not sure, or did they say fantastic?
It depends on who you're asking about: customers, retailers, or distributors.
Let's talk about retailers, because that obviously was the really important step.
Yeah, it's been interesting. I think the reaction ranges, and a lot of it is dependent on the type of account. Ironically, we've had a lot less pushback from accounts that are higher end and don't carry any other boxed wines because they see it as a eco-friendly and convenient alternative to super premium bottled wines. They understand the allure of boxed wine, but they maybe haven't carried one before because they haven't felt one met the standards of their customer base. And so we actually didn't, you know, we've gotten a great reaction from sort of like higher end accounts, interestingly. Yeah, I think where we get like some pushback or just some questions is from people that, you know, maybe they have boxed wine that sells really well, but it's sub $20. And there's a question about whether or not people will pay more for that.
Do you think people at the higher end were used to dealing with those boxed whiskeys and those gift boxes? Or do you think that's an irrelevant comparison?
I've never thought about it, but I think that's a great theory. Yeah, it definitely could be that they're more open to the format. They're more familiar with it.
Okay. So what was the proof of concept? How much did you end up selling before a wholesaler or a distributor said, yes, that's good enough. You've proved it. What was the tipping point for you?
I mean, there was no one tipping point because we were, you know, talking to a lot of different distributors and we got them to agree at different periods of time, right? There wasn't like one inflection point where, oh, we got to 2,000 cases and everyone said yes. It was really just a matter of us being very persistent, continuing to follow up with every sort of proof point we could come up with. And then eventually, you know, someone took a chance on us and then another one took a chance on us. And I will say, like, there's an interesting pattern that emerged, which could be a coincidence, but I like to think it's not, where almost of our first four or five distributors that we worked with, four of them had a woman decision maker in a leadership position.
That is interesting.
Again, small sample size, could have been a coincidence, but I like to think that it took a woman in a leadership position to see this product that resonates very specifically with women to sort of really understand and get behind what we were doing. That's been a theory that I've had for a long time. No way to prove it, but it's definitely a pattern we've seen.
That is so interesting. Okay, so now you get into retail. How do you enter chains without compromising the pricing or the positioning of it? How do you retain your, you know, what you want to do, and how much do you have to compromise when you start dealing with these big businesses?
So I think we were fortunate in that we really did, again, plan to be in retail, and we wanted to be in big box retail from the early days. And so when we put our pricing strategy together and our pricing grids for all the respective states that we're in, we definitely took into account all the things we knew about what these types of retailers would expect from a margin perspective and from a, you know, a quantity discount perspective, depending on the market, it's different things. And so we were really, I have to say, we were pretty forward thinking about that. And we did bake that into our margins from the start. I can't take any of the credit for that. That was all Aaron Smith. We have an incredible VP of sales. We couldn't do any of this without her. She's got a lot of experience in wine and spirits, and she took all her knowledge and really guided us in the right direction as it pertained to pricing and distributor management and all that.
That's something I haven't asked you that I should. When did you take on your first staff member?
So, I'm not going to remember the date exactly, but it was around the time that we launched in market. And that's when we first had a marketing, a full-time employee, then a few sales managers. And then as we were gearing up to launch in retail through our wholesalers, that's when we recruited Aaron. She's someone that I'd worked with at Pernod Ricard, has such an impressive resume, and we were somehow able to convince her to join this crazy journey we're on.
So if you were going to advise a small startup business about who they should employ as their first person, what would you recommend? Would you recommend a salesperson or would you recommend a marketing person?
Oh, that's a great question. And I have to say, I know this is an annoying answer, but it depends.
Right. Yes, that is an annoying answer. Come down on one side or the other.
I think for us, I can tell you how we thought about it. So, you know, in the early days, Lauren and I, my business partner and I, we were hand selling into accounts. And so we felt like having a marketing person on board to help us execute and implement our marketing strategy while we were doing that, we felt like that was a better setup in the early days, simply because we know how powerful it is to have a founder of a business out there in the field talking to retailers. And so that was the split that we went out with. But I'd say they're both really, really important. I mean, that's how you get things started, right?
Sales can also be quite confronting for many people, especially if you're cold calling and so on. Did you find that people in the wine business in retail are open to meeting you, or did you have to really push?
I think people were really open. Mm-hmm. It's definitely, you know, we're not going to get yeses across the board, but I think, again, like the fact that we had something really fresh and innovative and new, I think people were, whether it was out of curiosity or they genuinely thought their customers would love it, we don't really feel we have a lot of issues getting meetings.
And did you go together, or did you split up and do more by doing it individually?
Divide and conquer. It is
divide and conquer.
The best thing about having a co-founder is there's two of you. So we've definitely been able to expand our reach and expand like the scope of what we can do as a leadership team by dividing and conquering. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Okay. Yeah. And you didn't just get into retail. You're also in on-premise. So what made boxed wine attractive to people in the on-premise?
It's been such an exciting development that was also such a surprise for us. So when we launched, we had absolutely no idea that the on-premise would ever be a possible channel for us. And our first few placements came very organically. Like we weren't selling into the on-premise. We weren't targeting them. It was, you know, buyers tasted our product somewhere and thought it was amazing and reached out to us. Or, you know, we knew someone who was aware of what we were doing, and then they came to us and asked, oh, can I serve this poolside at my hotel? And so It all happened in the early days very, very organically, but it's been very successful for us. And so I think we want to, in the future, expand that channel in a bigger way. It's also a great differentiator for us as a boxed wine.
Yeah. Would you ever see yourself doing something like making designs, especially for the on-trade, and differentiating it that way?
Absolutely. That's something that we've talked about internally. It's an idea we've tossed around. We'd love to get to a place of, you know, more national brand awareness before we do that. You know, we want everyone to know Juliet and really understand that this is the signature format of our product. But then I think, you know, doing these sort of private label type, you know, line extensions for hospitality groups, like that's very exciting to us and definitely something we hope to do in the future.
Okay. I want to go back a step and talk about what you learned DTC and about your customer. You know, you mentioned that the customer wasn't the person you thought it was. What was your journey to understand the customer?
Well, I mean, the customer was broadly who we thought it was. It was just that we really needed to validate that, and we got a lot more specifics. And so, you know, what we found through, you know, both measuring in measurable channels, so whether it's Google Analytics or our social media channels, we found that our customer is over 80% women under the age of 44. And so that was really, it was a validation, because we always thought we'd resonate more with women, but it was surprising just like the massive share. Our audience is very focused on young women, which was, you know, we weren't sure if it would be a bit broader than that. One other sort of surprise is, you know, we didn't know from day one, would we be one of those brands that maybe only resonates in these coastal communities like New York, LA, Miami, or would we have this, you know, broader national reach? And what we did find through our direct-to-consumer data is that our customer is national. We really have a lot of representation, a lot of customers all over the country. It's very spread out. It's also, you know, we really over-index in these sort of like suburban areas and like tier two, tier three markets. And so that was a little bit of a surprise. We weren't sure.
So you mentioned that when you were doing DTC that you changed your price. Did you start high and then come down, or did you find that your high price was right? How did the pricing change as you sort of experimented?
Yeah, we started high. I think our first price point online was like, I want to say it was like above 40, which isn't crazy if you think about it, because we're a 1.5 liter. So that's, you know, two $20 bottles of wine. That's sort of who we, what we thought our customer was drinking. And then, you know, what we did was a, I think, 3 month long Google optimized campaign where you can actually test conversion rates of different price points on your e-commerce site. And so we were able to test, I don't remember how many different price points it was, but it was quite a few, and see anywhere from, you know, $25 up to $45. Where are we seeing the highest conversions, and where are we seeing the highest value per conversion? And so what we ended up finding that our sort of sweet spot was actually closer to around $30. We were definitely, you know, had to reduce our price quite a bit. But again, that was part of our strategy. Like, I don't think we ever thought we would stay at the high price point that we set out with. But we, again, like, we didn't want to leave anything on the table. You never know. And so it was important to us to test the limits of what we thought the consumer would pay.
Did you discover that your customers were trading up from glass bottles, or trading across, or were they trading up from boxed wine?
So that's a great question. And we've done a little bit of research around that. And, you know, every year we do a big customer insights study. You know, we send it out to our email list, which at this point in time is like tens of thousands of people on it. And what we found is that the vast majority of our customers are actually trading over from like $15 bottles of wine. So we are getting that super premium traditional bottled wine customer, and they're turning to us for something that's eco-friendly or more convenient or fits into their lifestyle better.
So when you get the feedback from them, what is it that they, what is the number one thing they like? Is it the fact that they can control the amount they're drinking without wastage? Is it the sustainability? Is it the beautiful design? What's the, I presume they like the wine, but what's the thing that really grabs them?
It's a combination of things. I would say the biggest thing that jumps out is great value for money.
Right.
So yeah, I think it's that you get, you know, 1.5 liters of pretty high quality wine for everyday drinking occasions. And it's in this beautiful package that looks like a little affordable luxury. And it is, you know, if you compare it to buying two bottles of wine, it's a great value. And so that has definitely emerged as one of the, you know, one of the attributes that we see converting best. And it's also increasing over time. So over time, that's become more and more important, which may be a sign of the times, right? Just in terms of the macroeconomic factors. But that's definitely something that's resonating. And then it is sustainability a little bit. It is convenience a little bit. But that's, you know, value for money really pops out.
Okay. So you've got an influencer and ambassador program. Am I right about that?
Yes, we do.
Tell me about that.
So we have an incredible, it's a micro influencer and affiliate program. We use a platform called ShopMy. We were actually the first alcohol brand on ShopMy. I think maybe one of the first beverage brands. It's a platform that is just beloved in the fashion and beauty community.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were able to convince them to take a chance on a beverage brand. And, you know, and I think it just kind of goes back to our backgrounds in fashion. Like, a lot of our marketing tactics and approach are rooted in that industry and what the brands in that space are doing. And so it's amazing. We have anywhere from 250 to 350 micro influencers and creators promoting Juliet every month. We can track all of the social media.
Oh, brilliant. Pages. So what do you do? Do you just send them wine and leave them to it? Or do you have, like, is this a professional arrangement, or how does it work?
So the platform connects you to these influencers. And so we can have conversations with them and offer them different things. So, you know, some of them have affiliate links. And so if they post a link to purchase online, they'll get a small commission on that. It's all connects to our Shopify store. So we can, you know, send them products at a discount through our Shopify store. We can, you know, reach out to them and talk about experiential moments, which is something that we're starting to do now that we've had this incredible retail expansion. We're thinking about ways that we can leverage our micro influencer community to create excitement and awareness for our retail placements. So, you know, for example, we're talking to several of our influencers right now about helping to promote Harris Teeter, which is a big new account that we just shipped product to. And so, you know, they're, if you can kind of picture it, they do their sort of day in the life content. It's a video of like, today I'm having my girls over for book club. I've got to go pick up like the spread and I'm going to go to my Harris Teeter and pick up Juliet and and charcuterie. And so it's all very organic into their content. And really the platform just allows you to, it facilitates that conversation and attracts everything.
All right. So the thing that we haven't talked about is we haven't talked about the wine. Obviously, you had a wine background before you started, but how do you choose the wine? And do you switch wine in and out as you're watching what consumers are drinking?
Yeah. So in terms of varietals that we offer, we started with three. We started with Pinot Noir, Sauvignon Blanc, and a Grenache Rosé, which is very light in style. And from there, we expanded to Cabernet Sauvignon, Chardonnay, and a limited edition orange wine. No, those expansions were all very much rooted in customer feedback. We felt that we really wanted to listen to our customer and at least try these varietals that they kept asking for again and again. So we now have six SKUs. And honestly, it's been great. Our best seller is our Sauvignon Blanc. So no surprise there, because I think there's a lot of growth in that varietal right now. But I also think our consumer just loves the light, crisp white wine. That's definitely something that, you know, we hear from a lot of women that they're drinking. But they all of the SKUs do well in different markets, different channels. Like each of them sort of have their bright spot. And the orange wine has been a bit of a surprise. We initially launched it as a very small limited edition item only on our website. I think we had maybe 200 cases our first year, our first vintage. And it sold really well. And then we got a lot of interest from retailers. So we ended up producing more. And now you can find it in some Total Wine stores. And actually, that got our foot in the door with Whole Foods, which was really exciting because that was a retailer that we had that had been top of our list for target retailers. So that one's done really well for us, too. And I think it's a little bit unique to see an orange wine in a box.
That's amazing. All right. So how much are you selling now? What's the scale of Juliet?
So this year we should be around like just under 15,000 cases, give or take. So we're still small, but we're growing. And I think right in this moment in time, like Q2, we've nearly tripled our door count and we've, you know, just entered these incredible key accounts like Costco and Safeway, Whole Foods, Harris Teeter. And so we're really excited to see how big those opportunities could get.
Are you at a stage now where they come to you, or are you still door knocking saying you need to know about this? Are you still out there pounding the pavement?
We are pounding the pavement every single day. and you know, when they say no, then we follow up next week and we just keep sort of preaching the gospel of what we're doing. And I think the more sort of wins we have under the belt, the more, you know, data points and proofs of concept that we have, it just starts to get easier and easier as we go.
I bet it does. Okay. So what's next for the brand? You've got more SKUs. Are you going to start putting international varieties in? Have you got, you know, what's the plan?
So the plan this year is really to double down and ensure that we have the growth where we're at. So we've really got a lot of incredible opportunities with retail expansion right now, and we want to make sure that we service those accounts and that we get customers excited about shopping in those accounts and that we do everything we can to ensure pull through off shelf. I think with so much of our team having a wine and spirits background, we are, you know, painfully aware that, you know, when you get the placement, that's when the work starts. And so we've really like fine-tuned our focus this year to be just laser focused on supporting all of these incredible retail partners and ensuring that we're a success there before we expand into other markets, other SKUs, you know, other formats even, which is something that's sort of in our long-term growth plan. So definitely want to grow where we're at before we expand further.
Okay, so a lot of people are going to be listening to this going, I want to do that as well. What's the big mistake or the reversal that you would never do again? That if you could advise people who are thinking about entering the wine space, what's the thing they must not do?
The thing they must not do. I would say something that I see a lot of founders in this space do is not, I don't know how to put this like politely, like not, they don't
do put it politely, just put it out there. This is a truth telling podcast.
They don't do their homework, right? It's wine and spirits is a very nuanced, complex category. I see a lot of people that have some experience in like a fast moving consumer goods, not alcoholic space. And they think that everything will directly apply. And then there's just a lot of surprises along the way as it pertains to the three-tier system, as it pertains to compliance, as it pertains to the nuances state to state, right? And so I do think if you are somebody that wants to launch a brand or a product in the alcohol space, you don't need to have that experience. There's so many examples of people that don't and succeed, but make sure you understand your blind spots. Make sure you get people on your side that do have that industry experience, because it's definitely, it's one industry. You have to have some people on your side that know the space. They know how to navigate it. I think it's important in a lot of categories, but it is especially important in alcohol.
So the next obvious question is, what's your blind spot that you get somebody else to sort out?
Oh my gosh. Well, I think for me personally as an individual, and I think I mentioned this before, I think fundraising was something that for me was a little bit daunting at first. And so, you know, having Lauren as a partner who's really excels at that in an extraordinary way was helpful. And then I think for us, you know, hiring an experienced sales leader was something that was a little bit polarizing. I think we had some stakeholders in the business tell us not to do that, just get a bunch of, you know, junior people on the ground who are going to like hustle for you. And we felt very strongly that, you know, the distributor system, the pricing nuances state to state, the ins and outs of that side of the business, you know, I was aware, like I kind of knew what I didn't know when it came to that stuff. We made the decision to hire someone more senior that had a lot of very deep experience and very deep relationships. And I think that's paid off. I think it is one of the reasons that we are where we are today, just 2.5 years into market. And we're starting to see incredible traction. I don't know that that would have happened if we hadn't hired someone senior and experienced in sales.
All right. So what's the end goal? Is this the start of a family dynasty in wine, or is one day you're going to sell it? What are you building towards?
I mean, I think the opportunities are sort of endless. You know, we definitely could build this into a larger platform for innovative wine brands, alcohol brands. I can see that happening. I can also see partnering with an established supplier at some point in the future. I think it could go either way. You know, our focus right now is just trying to get it to the point where we have those great choices in front of us. But we're open. We're really passionate.
So if I come back in 15 years, you might have a whiskey, you might have a tequila, you might have a champagne brand as well.
Maybe. I mean, oh my gosh, a champagne brand would be the dream. I got to work on Perrier Jouet a little bit at Pinot,
right. Nice.
And that was just such a fun, unique experience. Yeah.
All right. So final thoughts. As you are probably very well aware, there is a lot of doom and gloom in the wine industry right now. Where do you think the opportunities and bright spots are?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're really, really optimistic about the wine industry, which I know is a little bit of a minority opinion right now. And what, you know, our focus is on being one of those bright spots of growth. We definitely want to show consumers, the media, the industry as a whole that, you know, I know it seems bleak right now, but there are There are innovative brands that are growing. There are those bright spots of growth. And, you know, if we can do it, anyone else can do it. And so
what's the difference between the innovative people who are growing right now and people who aren't, do you think?
I mean, that's a great question. I'm trying to think of an example of an innovative brand that's not growing, because I have to say all the ones I'm aware of and friendly with are still seeing growth against the backdrop of sort of this stagnant moment.
I'm trying to tease out why. Is it because you're so sophisticated about things like using influencers and using data and having a very good business strategy, which a lot of people in wine don't have? Or do you think it's the fact that you're offering a new way to drink wine? What could you pinpoint maybe?
I think the through line, if you think about other brands like Juliet that are growing right now, like I think about Winey Baby comes to mind. I know you spoke to Jess recently. Aveline comes to mind. I mean, they're absolutely on fire. I think what we're doing that is maybe a little bit different is just genuinely listening to the customer and the modern customer and giving them what they want, right? Like maybe because we're newer brands, we're not as rooted in the way things have always been done. And so it gives us the ability to be a little bit more reactive, a little bit more nimble, and really listen to what the customer is looking for, not only from a product perspective, but from a messaging perspective. How do they want to be talked to? Where do they want to be engaged? Like what platforms should we engage with them on? So that is one through line that I see with some of the brands that are sort of becoming these like breakthrough brands at the moment, is that they're just really like honestly listening to the customer and delivering and not sort of hampered by this tradition and the ways that things have always been done.
Well, those are fantastic insights and congratulations. I think it's clearly a fantastic brand, and thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me on. This was so fun.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome.